Hi there. Welcome to another edition of the Dishcast. We've been on a roll lately, and we have a whole bunch of new guests coming up. Kara Swisher, Adam Moss, George Will, Johan Hari, Noah Smith, Nellie Bowles, Bill Maher, and Van Jones. Really stellar lineup. It's really encouraging. People are listening, and the right people are listening, and obviously lots of people want to come on and join the conversation we've been having, which brings me to my guest this week, with whom I've been having a conversation on and off for a couple of decades. And he's a good friend of mine, and he's a remarkable and dogged journalist. Digs into some of the toughest national security intelligence questions, and he's a former senior national security correspondent for the Daily Beast and Newsweek, and a former columnist for the Bloomberg View, the cushiest job in journalism. And he's now a reporter, of course, for the Free Press, Barry Weiss's new outfit, and a contributing editor at Commentary Magazine, where he submits his more vituperative columns, and the host of his own podcast, The Re-Education, with, drumroll, Eli Lake. Eli, thank you very much for coming.
Andrew, it's so great to be here. Thank you for having me.
You know, I don't get to see you anymore because you're a daddy.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm a daddy, but you're a real daddy.
Yes.
You actually have a baby. And
she's 2 and a half now.
I know.
You'll have to meet her. I mean, you'll like, she's
yeah,
great.
Yeah, I'm sure.
We love her.
But from my point of view, there's no more Eli at brunch. From my point of view, I miss you anyway.
I think she's at the age now where I can bring her around. She requires a lot of attention, but she's a great eater and she loves restaurants, I should say that.
Really?
Yeah, she does.
She's well behaved in restaurants?
No, she is not.
She's not going to
interrupt she will interrupt and she will conduct her science experiments where she pours water from a glass into her plate and then tries to pour the water back into her glass. But it's a great experience, and you know, I mean, I love being a dad. So
has it changed you in any way?
Yes, I think about issues that I more or less, such as our, you know, we're thinking about preschool and things like that, and it hits more viscerally. And I think I haven't gone full Sarab Amari, but I have become more open to the idea that there is a crudeness or obscenity at times in culture when I think about my daughter encountering things on the internet in a way that my sort of libertarian instincts, I still have many of those libertarian instincts. So I'm not changing sides, but I'm much more sensitive to it, I'd say.
But you're aware that there are costs as well as benefits and that there are.
That is something. And it's not, I did not make a conversion of some sort. Like, I'm not saying, you know what, all this free speech is bad and let's, you know.
No, you've just evolved a little bit.
Yeah, right.
The basis of your own lived experience.
There you go. Yeah.
Just about your very earliest lived experience. Like, where were you born?
I was born in Philadelphia and I was raised in a neighborhood called Germantown, which is part of Northwest Philadelphia. I was a latchkey kid and took public transportation. And
what did your parents do?
Well, my father was in telecom sales. He sold telephone systems. And this is the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and a period when these were, you know, considered kind of high tech. When we think of telephones today, but at the time it was like, you know, for a newspaper or business or something like that, you had to get all these, you know, you had to kind of get the suite system, that early technology. And my mother taught French and Spanish in high school. And kind of was just, I hope I get my intellectual curiosity from her because she kept educating herself and got her master's plus 60, as it's known. And she's still, to this day, constantly reading and telling me things I should check out and read. And
did she talk to you as a kid?
Yeah.
Like, as if you were an adult? Like, just
yeah,
talking
I would say
about
she,
the news?
She would encourage me. I mean, when I expressed an interest in maps, she got me a book of maps. She would make sure that I was a curious kid, and she would make sure that I was sort of, she would feed that, and it was a very good experience. And
I'm really grateful. My mom,
yeah,
I mean, she did have a borderline personality, but that meant in some ways that she often just talked endlessly to you and
yeah,
addressed you and never condescended either, and just expected you to be listening to the radio where she was and hearing the news and then opining about them and then talking to you at 4 years old about it.
Well,
and I sort of absorbed it, you know?
Well, I think I'm sort of the last of the true neoconservatives in that I was raised very left. My mother took me to protests and she told me about...
Go on to this. Come on.
Well,
cough it up.
Yeah, well, she would... You know, I was raised very left and I was... When I went to college, I mean,
What does that mean, raised very left?
We had a babysitting cooperatives. I went to something... I'm Jewish and I went to something called the Jewish Children's Folk Shul, which was a branch of secular Judaism for my bar mitzvah project. I did a project on Jewish perspectives on nuclear proliferation, which turned out to be, you know, very from kind of a very left-wing perspective. I had a tutor. You know, my mother, you know, I didn't know anybody who voted for Republicans. You know, growing up, we would occasionally have people give us presentations about the situation in Central America and, you know, how the Reagan administration was funding these Contras who were, you know, doing all these terrible things. So, and I was fairly left for the beginning of college. I wrote a column in my newspaper. I went to Trinity College and I wrote for the Trinity Tripod. And I had a column, which I will tell you was called Why I Am a Socialist. So I had strong views kind of at that point. But I would say the process of going through college in the early 1990s made me begin to turn right. That was the first wave of PC, as you remember. I was a New Republic reader at the time.
New Republic.
You were the New Republic editor at the time.
I'm so bloody old.
Later, you know, I would write for the New Republic, but I would say it was sort of the beginning of a process, and a book that had a profound effect on me, kind of making me go more towards the right, was a book called Free to Choose by Milton Friedman and his wife, which was a new perspective for somebody who had like volunteered for the public interest research group and just believed that the answer to the environment was more regulation and that, you know, Ralph Nader was a secular saint and all these other things. And so that was the sort of planting the seed.
And how did their leftism and Jewishness interact?
Well, my family, like a lot of Jewish families in America, we had enormous respect for education. And so my parents had a lot of friends who were college professors and then in the arts. And they were kind of part of my life growing up in Germantown in Philadelphia, which is a really vibrant neighborhood.
Is it still? Is it roughly what it used to be? Was it basically a Jewish neighborhood when you grew up?
I wouldn't say it was a Jewish neighborhood. I would say it was a liberal neighborhood. I would say, I mean, there were a lot of Jews, but it was
like Brookline or something.
Yeah, Brookline's a suburb. I mean, this was in the city, but okay. It was. So growing up in that milieu, having these conversations at the dinner table, which were very political, there was a kind of an expectation this is what normal was. And then I began to lean right when I just didn't agree with some of the... I had written a parody piece for the newspaper that was a fake review of A Tribe Called Quest. I called it A Tribe Called Rape. And I was kind of making fun of the tendency of radical feminists to find hidden meanings in things. So I was, you know, deconstructing this classic rap album by A Tribe Called Quest, which is called The Low End Theory. And I remember there were people who read it who were hip hop fans who thought I was out of my mind, but I didn't. I wrote it.
Maybe for those of our listeners who are not hip hop fans, you could explain the reference.
Sure. A Tribe Called Quest is part of the Native Tongues movement. You could say they weren't one of the original hip hop groups that start, maybe you could say, in the early 1980s. They come a little bit after Run DMC. The Native Tongue movement was a kind of, it wasn't a collective, but it was a group of artists and lyricists who celebrated the fact that they weren't necessarily growing up in the city and they weren't aspiring to be gangsters. A lot of the original kind of text of the Native Tongues was De La Soul's first album, 3 Feet High and Rising. That record was dubbed that they were the rap hippies because they deliberately did not want to say that they were hard or that they were embracing that kind of thing. From a production perspective, a lot of this music is really very much ahead of its time in that it was much more layered. And if you hear these records, they sound much fuller than some of the Run DMC or the first Beastie Boys. So Tribe Called Quest, I think, really was the standout act from that group. And when I was in college, The Low End Theory came out. I think it's one of the, it's you should go and listen to it. It's really brilliant. And so that was the idea, that I was, what I was saying was that if you, you know, kind of decoded it, and I had just been exposed to Helene Sissou and Catherine McKinnon, and I found them ridiculous, and I wanted to sort of see if I could write like that. This was the whole thing, and I wrote under an obvious pseudonym. Instead of Eli Lake, it was Ellie Pond. And so there were some people who loved hip hop who thought I was crazy when they kind of figured it out. But then there was an uproar from some of the women's studies types. And I remember being, you know, a professor mentor type who I was in his office, and another woman was really upset about the piece. And, you know, there was an apology. I ended up writing another piece sort of explaining that I was on it. I mean, it was a young kid.
What was the point of the piece? You were making fun of the album? The fact that it was basically an argument.
I was making fun of what I saw as a kind of tendency among radical feminist critics.
I see.
To find such, you know, to plumb the depths of alleged subtext to then prove that something was, you know, what I thought it wasn't. Okay. So it was a style of literary criticism which I had just encountered as
How
a young.
How old were you when you were doing a style of literary criticism about hip hop?
I think I was 19 or 20.
Okay.
I say.
So yeah. From the beginning, you know, you're getting into hip hop at an early age.
Oh, yeah. I was into hip hop. I mean, I had the good fortune of going to public school until high school, but when I was in elementary school, the first rap albums came out, and you could hear it in the streets. We had it when we would have, you know, free time or what they call projects in our school, which was just the time when you could do whatever you want. I would listen to, you know, the original Sugar Hill Gang. And then, you know, growing up in Philadelphia, you had the advantage of Power 99, which is a radio station, and they had one hip hop show on Sundays with Lady B. And so I got a chance to sort of hear it in its very beginning.
Do you have any idea why you, this little Jewish nerdy boy, would suddenly become really captured by this new?
It's exciting.
Okay.
I mean, it's anytime you hear a new thing, mm-hmm. especially if you're young, and I loved music. Mm. Yeah, it wasn't the only thing I listened to. I mean, like every other person, I listened to the Beatles, and my parents had a record collection, and I played piano as a child, and I had the great advantage of being in a neighborhood where I could take lessons from a really good jazz pianist. So I was exposed to a lot of music. It's just, this was a new thing, and it was exciting. And it was not, and it was, it was so new, I didn't know that it wasn't supposed to be for me,
right?
Per se. I just thought it sounded great.
But in fact, there were many like you, actually.
Oh, yeah.
White teenagers who were, this brings me back to a cover I did at the New Republic in the 90s, which was written by David Samuels, the now editor of The Tablet.
Love David Samuels.
And he did the real market for rap or hip hop.
Yeah,
we had this guy with the preppy collar on the front cover, which I got completely reamed for, of course, because I'm fucking white supremacist, et cetera, et cetera. But it was a really smart and interesting essay. And is this, because I get a little confused with R&B, hip hop, house, and then you have rap. And can you help me? Because house music was coming around at the same time, right?
That's right.
Because that's what I was kind of hearing in gay clubs. I was hearing the beginning of house music, which was, again, like you with hip hop, it was something I'd never heard before.
Right.
It kind of hit me up the spine. It had this deep bass.
Yeah.
Something was going on there that I was like attracted
right.
to.
Right. And it's the new, it's, you can tell it's fresh, and you can tell that the people making the music don't know what they're doing yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes it so exciting.
Mm-hmm.
So you almost kind of like it for the little errors. You know, you like it because it's imperfect. And, you know, whenever you have a chance to kind of be on the ground floor of any cultural movement, it's very exciting for people.
You've
like
just
us.
Written, actually, this really, brother, I think, brilliant essay on your love of Kanye West.
Yes.
And it's really an essay in defense of the art over the artist, and yet
yes.
you also have a long. When did you first? When did Ye, whatever he's now named as, come into your consciousness? When did that man?
Well, as somebody who loves hip hop, I knew about him because he was the producer on The Blueprint by Jay-Z. So he had been a producer; he'd been coming up, and he was considered a young phenom, and he had developed a signature sound, you know, before he was 20 almost. It was like he would speed up old 70s soul records and then put these very heavy drums with them. And Jay-Z did this very well. and everybody was copying it, and it was the Kanye sound. Now, what I explain in the piece is that most people who do the production are not the rappers. There's a division of labor, and there's a reason for that, because it's hard to rap, and there's very different sets of skills. And Kanye wanted to be a rapper, and he insisted on it. He talks about how he would stand on the table at Rockefeller Records, which is Jay-Z's label, and demand that people like listen to what he was just coming up with. It was kind of like a crazy person. And eventually he got his record deal, and it finally came out in, I think it's 2003, and it's called College Dropout. It's like no other rap album that came out at the time, because it's the perspective of somebody who did not grow up in extraordinary poverty. It's this perspective of somebody whose mother wanted him to go to college and he couldn't do it. And you hear, there's a wonderful song called Jesus Walks, which you have to listen to, because he builds it. You hear this chorus and it sounds almost gothic. But then it's, you know, he's talking about kind of racism, and he's talking about where Jesus, it's religious rap in 2003. And like, who was doing that? No one back then. Now there's a whole subgenre.
And he, of course, is part of it.
Yeah. He did an entire album called, I think, Jesus Saves Her. And so I loved it when it first came out. And I didn't think he was the best rapper, lyricist. He wasn't like an Eminem or Jay-Z in terms of his skill level. But it was okay, because I didn't think anybody was doing anything like it. And then he just kept putting out so much material, and all of it was interesting and good. And he has the great quality of really great artists like Bob Dylan, where he completely changes everything up. He made an album called 808 and Heartbreak, which was the first record to really use kind of tone or pitch shifting, which is the signature sound of Drake. You hear it everywhere now on the radio. He was like the first person to really do that. And it was barely a rap album. It was almost like this very emo, almost gloomy meditation. And I just was, it was exciting to listen to Kanye. If you listen to his album, it's an album called Yeezus. That sounds almost like heavy industrial music, which he made with Rick Rubin. And it's kind of like rubbing up against almost a punk feel. And, you know, he's like many great artists, he's obsessed with himself. He's an egotist. And so.
And obviously he also has some mental illness.
I think he does have mental illness. He does. It's an interesting question, Ren. You're talking about
someone that genius is the way.
Geniuses who have mental. So is it a.
Where does it begin? Where does it end?
Well, I don't know. I don't think there's an easy answer to that. I've always been fascinated by this question of people who have some greatness in them, you know, creatively. And then is that a manifestation of their madness? Does it help to be off? Does it help to have a different mental balance that allows you to sort of see things or perceive things in a certain way if you're an artist? I don't know the answer to that. I'd love actually to hear your thoughts on that, because I think you can go back and you can like ask, you know, I don't know. I mean, this applies to, you could argue Pablo Picasso had some mental problems. He was a terrible misogynist. And there's a whole...
Van Gogh. I mean, there are lots of...
Yeah, absolutely. Van Gogh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, that especially seems to be the case with visual artists or musical artists as opposed to writers, because it does get in the way of writing. Although then you have someone like Nietzsche, who's clearly either the most brilliant man of, you know, his time, or completely bonkers, or some weird combination.
Right. See,
the fact that we're reading this allegedly bonkers man hundreds of years after his death and still believing it actually has a real potency in our culture,
yeah,
and our society suggests not entirely bonkers.
Ezra Pound probably had a mental imbalance, certainly made bad political choices, was a terrible anti-Semite, and one of the great, great poets.
Eliot is, in my mind, the greatest poet of the 20th century in English,
yeah,
in my opinion. And absolutely, I mean, there's parts of his letters and even some of the verses that are just horrible. You can listen to the four quartets, or you can read The Wasteland, and it's still an extraordinary, extraordinary piece. Again, out of nowhere, a completely new way of doing things.
Right. I mean, he coined that wonderful phrase that was picked up by James Jesus Angleton, who knew him, of the wilderness of mirrors, which Angleton believed explained the entire Russian disinformation scam. I mean, it was like one line in Gerontium, mm-hmm, and then that is like the basis for an entire way that, you know, the CIA's somewhat mad original counterintelligence, the person who built the counterintelligence capabilities for the CIA, believe that this one phrase sort of helped explain and unlock what he was doing in terms of a kind of political information war against the Soviets speaks to Eliot's genius.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by Kanye because, you know, you sort of set your watch with someone like this. And
yeah.
And at some then this anti-Semitism came out.
Yes.
Did you have any premonition of that? Was that something that really shocked you when it happened? Or are there things in his work or just in the nature of him that would lead to that?
When it first happened, I really did chalk it up to his mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a part of me that wanted to invite him, you know, that hoped that Barry Weiss would invite him to a Shabbat dinner and just say, hey, Kanye, you got us all wrong.
Kanye and Elon and Barry and whoever.
Yeah, right.
Peter Thiel, a few other dark vultures of the IDW. Yes, maybe that would have done the trick, but maybe not.
No, but then he seemed to sort of be leaning into it, and these were classic tropes that we all recognize, and they're ugly.
I know.
And I just couldn't, and I didn't want to like his latest album, Vultures, one. But I have to acknowledge that there was something kind of great about at least parts of it. I didn't think it was his best album or anything, but I couldn't turn it away and say it was just trash.
That was you, I think, at your liberal best, at your sort of that side of you anyway. But I think one of the things that just if you try and get off planet Earth for a minute and think about this, what on earth, why does anti-Semitism revive? I mean, where do you ascribe its tenacity? I mean, this is a tiny number of people in the world, right?
Yeah.
By any standards, there are not many in a world of 8 billion or whatever. And there are a million different things to write about, think about, ways of explaining the world. And yet somehow this particularly weird and esoteric thing doesn't just continue. It jumps cultures. It finds roots suddenly. Now it's found roots in youth culture all over the world. It's something that is all over TikTok. We thought we'd buried it. What's your take on why someone like Kanye or why this thing keeps coming?
Well, I think
back? It's
two different things. I mean, one is that. I mean, if you were to give Kanye the benefit of the doubt here, it's that if you wanted to be an edgelord, if you want to be, if you want to shock, this is one of the easiest ways you can do it. So if he is looking to fight cancel culture, as he sometimes says, then, I sort of say that some of the things that Candace Owens is doing is, if you want to be charitable, is coming from this desire to shock, desire to sort of push limits and boundaries and things like that.
Say the unsayable.
That kind of thing. However, there's another part of this as well, which is that if you start going down the road of believing conspiracies, that things are secretly controlled, well, I mean, it's as ready-made for you. Now, but people who believe conspiracies, that believe that there are these powers that are behind, behind the curtain that are controlling everything, well, that is a sign of powerlessness in a way.
What is the
if you believe that
they have
actually
to hide
that your reality is actually manipulated in some way, that the media is controlled, that the banks are controlled, that everything in your life is controlled by a secretive cabal that doesn't let anybody know that it exists, well, that's an admission in some ways that you believe that you are powerless, that you can't change anything, and there's no point in kind of participating in the best sense of participating in a democracy because, it's all a scam.
It's rigged, yeah.
It's rigged. It's kabuki theater. And so as long as there are many people who are susceptible to that and there are demagogues to stoke it who may not even believe it, I think the Jews are that's the ready-made explanation, even though sometimes you will hear people who express that same kind of powerlessness in the sense that things are being secretly controlled. And they don't say Jews, they say
the Freemasons.
The Freemasons, Illuminati or something.
The British Royal Family.
Exactly.
Wasps.
The Trilateral Commission. Right.
Yes.
Right.
All the people that hang out at those weird lodges.
Right.
Or they go to these.
Right, exactly. That's
the
exactly
kind of places that I would have to be paid a large amount of money to go into.
Right.
Or to attend.
Right. Right.
But it's still weird that in those shadowy things, the Jews are always central.
Well, again, you'll get there eventually.
Okay.
Eventually, it could start with usually a shocking and horrible event like COVID or 9/11. How could this happen? And you don't believe the explanations, or the explanations are unsatisfactory.
There's also a sense, if you are powerless, if you are at the butt end of society in some ways and feel that your life is like that, it makes you feel better to think it's not your fault in any way. That in fact, there's no one could work in this system.
Yeah, and there's also a sense, if you believe it, that you have this kind of understanding.
Yeah, which also gives you a kind of social prestige with your friends. I'm more sophisticated. I know what's really going on.
Yeah, there's a kind of, it's fake empowerment.
Right, right.
Even though it's the ultimate expression of powerlessness, right?
Yes.
Why? How could I possibly compete with these people who, set the interest rates and whatever else and put fluoride in the water? And
as this teenager is listening to Kanye and early adult young man who is doused in hip hop, you're also obviously very interested in national security. You're interested in the defense of the West. You're also interested, of course, in the security of the state of Israel. Can you tell me how those things go together?
Well, first of all,
how they went together in your life.
I feel like I don't think that there's one true. I mean, I don't think there's a single political narrative of hip hop. I think that there's all kinds of interesting political narratives in hip hop. So I should say, start with that. So part of hip hop is this is really a kind of souped up version of the Horatio Alger story. Mm-hmm. It's I came from nothing and now we're at the top, which is I paraphrased a Drake lyric there. Mm-hmm. Some of it, at times, like Public Enemy, Brand Nubian, is black nationalism. Mm-hmm. It's radical politics. It's a kind of echo, if you will, of, the 1968 generation, liberation stuff. Mm-hmm. Sometimes hip hop is just dance music and fun. Mm-hmm. And it's a vibrant art form because there's constantly room for people to kind of critique and to modify.
I think people of any politics can enjoy any art form if they're
absolutely
able to separate the two out in their heads.
Yes.
And in fact, having these different realms in your mind is part of what makes life worth living. And it's a great advantage of being in a free society that we can dip in and out of different kinds of discourse and different kinds of way of seeing the world.
Well, so I had a joke in 2008 when Obama was running versus John McCain. And I said, actually, Senator McCain is the true candidate for the hip hop community because he actually has spent time incarcerated and he's in favor of gun rights. So
I remember trying to argue in 96 that Bob Dole was the real incarnation of Gen X, because he was...
Oh, I remember this piece, actually. with the whatever and like how he was just fine with it.
It was the way he was totally post everything. And I remember one thing he used to say is that he was asked about his defense of, I don't know, the Disability Act that they did. And he was like, oh, yes, I'm in favor of rights for women, for gays, for African, for whoever.
That's great.
He was in favor of them forever. And I just thought he was, first of all, he was over everything and over everyone. And he had this incredibly dark side to him that was also very funny. I endorsed him in 96. I wrote a column
saying, remember.
I'm voting for this dude because I think this guy, Clinton, is headed for calamity, which I wasn't completely wrong about
completely
in terms
wrong.
Of the lies and everything. But it just shows you, we can... We can make the world fit our desires whichever way you want. But so how did you... So your parents are also teaching you, presumably, about Israel, and that fits into the old socialist farmers, as Hitler would say.
Yeah, I would say I did go to a summer camp called the Habonim Dror, which was based on the kibbutz model.
Okay.
So it was called... The one I went to was called Camp Galil. And I did not have a very good experience in summer camp. I was kind of an awkward kid at the time. I was obsessed with a nuclear apocalypse because of the day after, and the remember the British series called Threads? Do you remember that?
I do remember. I don't know why people were a lot of people were traumatized by those things.
And so it got me, I had to learn, and that's why I did my bar mitzvah project on like the Jewish perspectives on these kinds of things. And I couldn't stop talking about it as like, you know, a 12 and 13 year old camp, and people just hated it. So
look, I was campaigning in the EU EEC referendum at that point.
Yeah.
We're both ultimate political nerds in our childhoods.
And I went to a Kiva Hebrew Academy, which is a Jewish school. And I think I went to Israel for first semester of my junior year. I lived in Jerusalem.
Oh, for a whole semester.
Yeah. And I loved it. And not enough to move there, but I loved the experience. And my favorite thing to do was after class you would go, this is Jerusalem in 1988. It's the first Intifada. I was just taken in by the vibrancy of the political culture, but I loved hanging around the hotels, and I would watch journalists, foreign correspondents, have what I thought was the greatest adult life, which was you could sit around, smoke cigarettes, drink, you know, and then something would happen and you had all this excitement and then you had to do it. And I sort of said, that's kind of what I want to do. And
so that's how you figured you'd like to be a journalist?
Yeah, I got into, I mean, I've always
from
liked
watching these louche old hacks
basically
smoking and drinking in some bars in Jerusalem.
I just thought, that seems like a pretty good life.
Yeah, well, that was the attraction, of course. You just hang out in bars all day long.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I knew with journalism as I grew up. They were just a whole bunch of drunks who knew each other and knew everything, got drunk and then, but somehow managed to go out there and find shit out and write it all up.
Yeah. And I think part of the reason I kind of went more right is because, you know, when I encountered it was very left wing when I went to college, and I encountered among other left wing students and things the beginnings of what we see now in full bloom, which is a real anti-Zionism. And it was it's not the reason that I became right. I think there were a lot of reasons for that, but it was something that I was uncomfortable with because I was raised on the idea that this is our safe haven. I was raised on the idea that, you know, this was Jews coming home to the land they were promised by God, even though I had a God optional Jewish education for at least the first part of my life there. And, you know, so it was uncomfortable. It was a dissonance about it. Although at the time, this is the early 90s, Andrew, and I'm sure you know this, there wasn't the stark contradictions between the left and Zionism was less apparent then. There was much more of a place kind of traditionally. I was reading recently like a biography of Golda Meir, and she like would talk about like, you know, she would lecture like, you're not being a very good socialist, you have to defend us and things like that. So there's a whole tradition within of labor Zionism, which sort of
most
kind
of it
came
with the
up
Labor in, Party in Britain too.
Yeah.
It became quite strongly allied with Israel.
Right. But no, we're
not
longer
around
in that.
Socialist principles, of course. That was
That was the idea. Israel was trying to become a model socialist state. And
if you could best express yourself their argument about why Israel is not what you think it is.
You mean whose argument?
The anti-Zionists.
Okay.
How did you understand their argument? I mean, just put it in the, I mean, if you were to, I try sometimes when I'm fighting with them,
sure,
what exactly did my opponent believe as such? And I try and articulate it myself because it helps me kind of figure out what I disagree with in it. And I mean, every now and again, I'm like, God damn it, they're right. Yes, I need to work that one out. There is a non-anti-Semitic, anti-Zionist strategic argument about the state of Israel that these people hold.
Well, I do think that there's an element of anti-Semitism in the anti-Zionist argument because I think it sort of denies Jewish claims to the land. But the argument is, and I think it starts with, for most of them, is that Israel is a settler colonial state, and that in that sense it's kind of artificial and illegitimate, and that the Palestinians have a right, as any peoples would who had their land colonized, to resist colonization. That, I think, that's the argument. It's one that I personally reject, but I think that can be made more honorably and less honorably by some. I mean, I think there's a way to do that argument without telling me that the IDF is harvesting the organs of Palestinians, which is a blood libel. But
right
there, but that is sort of the nuts and bolts of it. That's
one of the quotes that I get thrown at me sometimes, come across the internet, is is David Ben-Gurion. Of course, he said lots of things.
Yes.
Sometimes quite outrageous things, and sometimes in the heat of conflict that one might not take seriously as words for the ages. But nonetheless, this is what he said. I'm just trying to think where this is from, Le Paradoxe Sharif. Anyway, if I were an Arab leader, he said, I would never sign an agreement with Israel. It's normal. We've taken their country. It is true God promised it to us, but how could that interest them? Our God is not theirs. There has been anti-Semitism, the Nazis hit Auschwitz, but was that their fault? They see but one thing, we have come and we have stolen their country. Why would they accept that? That's Ben-Gurion trying to understand why the inhabitants...
When did he say that?
I don't know, actually. I really should have dug into that.
Because Ben-Gurion, until, I would say, the mid-30s, held out hope that he could reach an accommodation with the Arab-Palestinian leaders at the time. He actually did at one point negotiate with, I'm going to screw up his name, I think it's
well, here's a 1938 speech quote.
Yeah.
Where he's this is from 1938. Let us not, from a speech, let us not ignore the truth among ourselves. Politically, we are the aggressors and they defend themselves. The country is theirs because they inhabit it, whereas we want to come here and settle down. In their view, we want to take away from them their country. Behind the terrorism by the Arabs is a movement which, though primitive, is not devoid of idealism and self-sacrifice.
Okay, so that's 38, though.
Right.
And you have to understand that in the 20s, Ben-Gurion and Jabotinsky clashed on this very idea. Jabotinsky's great essay, The Iron Wall, was a rebuke of Ben-Gurion's kind of optimism that if we just show that, you know, Jewish settlement will bring jobs and Jewish settlement will, you know, that we can share the land and that there's, you know, an opportunity for us to do this without war. And he really believed that, I would say, until probably 33, 34. And then when the British proposed the Peel Commission, which is the first partition plan, I would, you know, the Yeshuv, which was the Jewish governing body at the time, accepted it with a few reservations, and it was entirely rejected by the Arabs, who then launched what's known as the Arab Revolt. There are then, you know, 47, there's another UN partition plan. Again, this is, you know, Ben-Gurion accepts it, and the Arab states, as well as the Palestinian Arab leadership, reject it. Now, you're right that at a certain point, I think there was an understanding among these early Zionists that there would be friction, and Jabotinsky, that was his kind of Jabotinsky's insight into this. But it was not, that was something that eventually Ben-Gurion and the labor Zionists came around to. And then in 48, there was a war, and certainly there were atrocities committed by the Haganah, and eventually it became the IDF. But there were always, it was a war. There were atrocities that were committed by the Palestinians and the Arabs. It was a vicious kind of fight. And I kind of reject the claim of that that's so central to the modern argument today, which is that 1948 was a Nakba, which is to be kind of considered in the same category as the Holocaust. Whereas I would say that 1948 was a war that the Israeli forces won against all odds, really, especially if you look at the fact that eventually the Arab states joined the fight, that there were arms embargoes on, you know, the Jewish state, which were violated, by the way.
But when you look at this, you realize one of the things that one might say is that from the very beginning,
yeah,
the Arabs are very clear. They do not want this in any way, shape, or form, period. It seems that, I mean, there's this, I got this too because it's one of the funniest headlines ever. The Onion, when they did their 100 years. Oh. November 9th, 1948, war-weary Jews establish homeland between Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt. I mean, there you have it. It was a huge gamble, right? I mean, and everyone knew from the start it would never really be accepted. Maybe, I mean, by 48, Ben-Gurion isn't under that illusion. So,
well, but oddly, it has been accepted by Egypt, Jordan, and now the United Arab Emirates. And the, I mean, listen, I think I would agree with a critique that if you had, say, the Abraham Accords signed by the Saudis are a monarchy, and that doesn't necessarily speak for the Saudis who live there. But it's remarkable that, you know, I don't know, how many years are we, 48 to, so we're what, 80 years almost into the state of Israel, that they are on the road to normalization with the other Arab states. But I would say, obviously, based on the last 6 months, they are further away from peace with the Palestinians.
Yeah. And maybe the Arab states because of the last 6 months.
You know, that's the dog that hasn't barked, Andrew. We haven't seen anybody pulling out of the Abraham Accords that are in it, even though I would imagine there's probably pressures on those regimes to do so.
Tell me, Jabotinsky is an interesting character, obviously.
Yeah.
Netanyahu's dad was close to him. Am I right about that, or am I wrong? Or
yes, he was.
A devotee
he was.
Of his, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, his father was a historian, and probably the greatest historian of the Spanish Inquisition. But
nobody
expects
the greatest history of the Spanish Inquisition. Sorry, you can't say those two words.
Yeah.
Sorry, anyway, I'm sorry. We just had a crowd of cardinals rush into the room. Leave!
Nobody expects.
But he seemed to understand or believe that all of Israel belonged to the Jews. I mean, from the river to the sea, to coin a phrase. And that was the destiny of Israel. And it seems that's also Netanyahu's clear view that they should control all of it.
I don't know what Netanyahu's clear view is, because I think he is driven so much by holding power. Because I'm not denying...
But clearly, obviously, not far away from being his father's son.
Well, yeah, but...
Well, the endorsement of settlements, the belief in settlements on the West Bank,
right,
is clearly a claim to the land. And that's the one... I have lots of sympathies with Israel. Let me just...
I would say it's a miracle.
It's a miracle.
You and I disagree, but I've been reading you, of course, and I think you express the anguish in a piece from, I think, 3 or 4 weeks ago of what the October 7th attack meant to the Jewish psyche. And it was the first time as a Jew living in diaspora that it felt like a kind of electric connection in some ways, because there was something that it evoked Chaim Bialik's account of Kishinev. It was something that was, this is actually what the world is like if there is no Jewish state for Jews in diaspora.
And it was designed to make that message, which was why in part it was so despicable.
Yes.
It's not the number of people killed, although there was a horrible number of people.
It was the fact
it was
that
the methods.
It was filmed.
The delight, the joy, the sadism, the complete dehumanization. This is out of Hitler's willing executionist. That was what you saw there. And I think anybody in the West who's read their history and need to have read their history would have recognized that instantly and understood exactly why Israel has to exist. At the same time, you are crippled by the thought that they're never going to get acceptance. They're going to be forever drawn into horrible situations.
Well, but how do you explain the fact that the relationship with, at least for now, of the rest of the Arab states has never been better?
Well, let's leave that.
Okay.
I'm talking now about just how you make Israel work.
Sure.
And it seems to me that the way it has been constructed, and my view is that the West Bank is the main, for my money, that's my main sticking point, is that I can't. I'm sympathetic with Israel in many, many respects. I think it's a miraculous place. I think that part of the hatred of it comes from envy of its success. To have done what they've done in that part of the world is extraordinary. And to have done so under these circumstances, even more extraordinary. But then I never expected less from Israelis or from Jews, from everything I've known about them. And I was like you. I was taken as I went to a kibbutz as a kid because we were supposed to understand. I was the Vatican II Catholics who were told, you better come to terms with what we did to the Jews and own it and deal with it and never, ever forget what happened. We went to Yad Vashem as a 16-year-old. It was a hugely powerful thing for me as a Catholic.
Yes, but one thing I actually want to study more is the dissident traditions within the Catholic Church, because it was always there, and there were always moments when you had a pope or you had various theologians who would tell you that this is wrong and that would say, well, these are our kin. These are like, you know, we're related to
these. Or when the plague hit, the Pope said, well, it's killing them too. It can't be their fault.
Right.
Why would they kill themselves?
No one is denying the great harm that over the centuries that the Catholic Church did to the Jews, particularly of Europe. But it's rather a much more complicated story because that to me is why history is so important and interesting. Because it's easy to just sort of like paint with a broad brush and say, oh, well, you know, all the Catholics until Vatican II.
Hated Jews and burned them at the first
time. That's not true.
But it can't be true because Christian doctrine is very clear about a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
And some of the distortions of the Christian doctrine are so obviously opportunistic and wrong. And, you know, I think you mentioned Augustine. Augustine obviously understood that obviously the Old Testament is very much part of a Christian's foundation. And therefore, the Jewish people offer huge support to Christianity. And yeah, we've taken it to the next step, but that doesn't mean they're just at an early stage of development. Maybe, and when the world ends, they will all come around. So we should honor them as the children of Abraham. They are part of our story.
I love this. In the Middle Ages, there were a lot of really good early humanist theologians who believed that Jewish mysticism and Kabbalah had made unlock magic or other kinds of knowledge, and that this is actually something we ought to learn. I mean, we talked earlier before the show about Johannes Reuchlin. He said his recommendation is every German university should teach Hebrew so that you can understand these texts in the original language. And to me, that's an extraordinary thing. It's an extraordinary thing to ponder that this guy lived a generation before Martin Luther, who was horrendous when it came to the Jews, and what happened, because they were in many ways saying the same thing in terms of the broader approach of humanism. So for me, it's like, wow, you know, that's an interesting question. Even though, you know, I as a Jew, I very much resent Martin Luther and what he said about our people.
Well,
yeah,
Martin Luther makes Kanye West seem like a simple liberal.
Yeah, he was over the top guy.
About over the top. You know, we Catholics were told all about Martin Luther's anti-Semitism, as well we should have. Tell me, because I understand the predicament of the Israelis in, for example, in 2000, when... Hi there. Really, I think this is not the end of this podcast. In fact, we're only just getting going. If you're a paid subscriber and are hearing this, it means you haven't yet signed up for the full new package to get our podcast in full. No extra charge. Just go to andrewsullivan.substack.com/listen, LISTEN. And make sure your podcast is up to date with the Dishcast. You'll be able to add it to your Dishcast feed and never have this hear this message again and go back to exactly what you've been doing for the last 2 years. And I'd like to thank you, too, for contributing for so long. If you're hearing this message and you haven't yet subscribed and want to listen to the rest of the podcast, then just subscribe. It's very easy. andrewsullivan.substack.com is $50 a year. Great value for money. And you also get with that the entire weekly dish every Friday. Not just my weekly column, but also all the comments and dissents on that column. You also have a full discussion of the previous week's Dishcast. So all those questions you had in your mind can be answered, or you can hear and read readers debating what we talked about, sometimes calling me to account. andrewsullivan.substack.com. Subscribe. And get the whole thing. Join the debate. Join the fun. Subscribe.